A Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are strapping in for a story that, well, it looks like just numbers on a page at first, but it turns into this amazing centuries-long quest. We're diving into Simon Singh's Fermat's Enigma.
Yeah, it's about the hunt for the solution to Fermat's last theorem. It's just an incredible story.
And it grabs you because the problem itself seems so simple, doesn't it?
Deceptively simple. You remember Pythagoras's theorem from school, right? Yeah. X squared plus Y squared equals Z squared.
Sure, like 3 squared plus 4 squared equals 5 squared.
Yeah.
Basic triangles. Lots of whole number answers.
Exactly. Infinite solutions. But Pierre de Fermat, back in the 17th century, he basically said, okay, what if you change that exponent, that little 2-point, to anything bigger, like 3 or 4 or 5 or, you know, any whole number higher than 2?
Right.
He claimed that suddenly there are no positive whole number solutions. None at all.
Wow. Just changing that one number breaks it completely.
Completely. And proving that claim took, well, almost 4 centuries.
And the significance, the reason we're talking about it now, isn't just about solving this one puzzle, right?
Not at all. Okay. The amazing thing is that the struggle to prove it, all those decades and centuries of near misses and failures, they actually forced mathematicians to invent entirely new fields of mathematics.
So the journey was almost more important than the destination.
In many ways, yes. It's this incredible story of human intellect, of persistence. It's about how abstract thinking can lead to, well, profound innovation. Think of it like a multi-generational relay race of ingenuity.
Okay, I like that. A relay race.
Yeah.
Let's unpack this. Let's start with the person telling the story. Who is Simon Singh? Why was he the right person for this?
Simon Singh, his background is really interesting. He's got a PhD in particle physics, actually worked at CERN.
CERN. Okay, so he definitely understands complex science. He's got the chops for the math part.
Right. He's comfortable with the technical side. But critically, he's also a fantastic storyteller. He spent about a decade at the BBC producing and directing science documentaries, including for the Horizon series.
Ah, so he knows how to make complicated ideas accessible. And engaging.
Exactly. In fact, this book, Fermat's Enigma, grew out of an award-winning BBC documentary he made back in 1996 about this very subject.
So he's not just writing for mathematicians. He's writing for, well, people like us. Curious people who maybe don't have a PhD in number theory.
Precisely. He translates things like, you know, elliptic curves and modular forms, which sound terrifyingly complex, into a really gripping human drama.
He focuses on the people.
Yes, the passion, the struggles, the rivalries, the sheer persistence. It becomes this unfolding narrative, not just a dry explanation of a proof.
Okay, so let's get into the book's core idea, the enigma itself.
Right. The central thing is that equation. X to the power of n plus y to the power of n equals z to the power of n.
XIZA.
And the claim is, no whole number solutions if n is anything bigger than 2. But the real kicker, the thing that started this whole 358-year saga, was how Fermat presented it.
This is the famous part, right? Mm. Pierre de Fermat, this 17th century French judge who did math for fun.
Yes, a brilliant amateur. He was reading this ancient Greek math text, Diophantus's Arithmetica.
And in the margin.
In the margin, he scribbles down the theorem, but then he adds this legendary, almost infuriating note.
Go on.
He writes something like, I have discovered a truly marvelous proof of this, which this margin is too narrow to contain.
No. He didn't really.
He did. That little note, it was like the ultimate mathematical cliffhanger. It just taunted mathematicians for centuries.
But hang on. Did he really have a proof? I mean, given how incredibly complex the final solution turned out to be, using math, he couldn't possibly have known.
Ah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Singh digs into this. The general consensus now is probably not. Or if he thought he had one, it must have been flawed. Because the actual proof, Andrew Wiles's proof, relies heavily on mathematical concepts developed in the 20th century, stuff Fermat just wouldn't have had access to.
So it was maybe a brilliant guess.
Right.
Or a bit of a bluff.
Could be. But whether he had it or not, the claim itself, that confidence, that mystery, that's what fueled the fire for over 350 years.
So the book traces this epic journey, shows how generation after generation tried and failed.
And how those failures weren't really failures in the end. They were stepping stones. Each attempt pushed mathematics forward, built new tools, new ideas.
Until finally, this one person, Andrew Wiles, puts it all together in the 20th century.
Exactly. A truly heroic effort.
Okay, let's walk through some of that history Singh lays out. Where does he start?
Wisely, he starts way back. Ancient Greece. Pythagoras.
Right. X squared plus Y squared equals Z squared. The foundation. They believed everything was about whole numbers, didn't they?
They did. They thought the whole universe ran on nice, neat ratios of whole numbers. Pythagoras' theorem seemed like perfect proof of that cosmic order.
But then they found numbers that didn't fit.
Exactly. The discovery of irrational numbers, like the square root of 2, you couldn't write it as a simple fraction. It apparently caused a huge crisis for the Pythagoreans. It shattered their neat worldview.
So that set a kind of precedent. Mm-hmm. That numbers could hold unexpected, complicated secrets.
Precisely. It sort of primed the mathematical world centuries later to grapple with Fermat's even trickier claim.
Then we jump forward to Fermat himself, the prince of amateurs.
Right. He drops this bombshell note in the margin and leaves it for others to figure out. And for a century, basically nothing happens. It's too hard.
Until Euler.
Leonhard Euler, yeah. The great 18th century mathematician. He managed with enormous effort to prove it just for the specific case when n equals 3.
Just n3. And it was that hard.
Immensely hard. His struggle really showed everyone, okay, this isn't just some clever trick Fermat forgot to write down. This is deep. This is fundamentally difficult.
But it wasn't just a story of famous men passing the baton, was it? Singh highlights others too.
Absolutely critical point. He tells the amazing story of Sophie Germain, early 19th century.
She faced huge barriers, right, as a woman in that era.
Totally. Women were barred from formal education, from universities, so she taught herself math in secret. She even corresponded with top mathematicians like Carl Friedrich Gauss, using a male pseudonym, Monsieur LeBlanc.
Wow. And did her work help with Fermat's theorem?
It did. She didn't solve the whole thing. Nobody did then. But she developed this really important general approach. It provided a framework for tackling whole classes of prime numbers in the exponent, a major conceptual leap done in complete isolation.
Incredible persistence.
And then you have maybe the most famous failure in the story, Ernst Kummer, in the mid-19th century.
What did he try?
He thought he had cracked it. He developed what seemed like a general proof for a huge number of cases. He even announced it.
Oh.
Yeah. Then it turned out there was a fundamental flaw in his reasoning. He'd assumed that number systems in these higher dimensions behaved like regular multiplication and division. They don't always. Yeah. Unique factorization breaks down.
So his proof collapsed.
It did. But here's the amazing part, the productive failure idea. To try and fix his broken proof, Kummer invented a whole new concept. Ideal numbers.
Ideal numbers. What are those, like, imaginary friends for numbers?
Huh. Sort of. Think of it like when you're working with these complex number systems, sometimes the usual rules of arithmetic leave gaps, like missing puzzle pieces that make proofs fall apart. Kummer created these ideal numbers to act as placeholders to fill those gaps and make the structure work again.
Okay, that sounds abstract.
It was, and revolutionary. Those ideal numbers became the foundation for a huge chunk of modern mathematics called abstract algebra, specifically algebraic number theory. His failure directly led to a massive breakthrough in pure math.
So his mistake was actually a gift.
A profound gift. It shows how trying to solve this one specific problem kept forcing mathematicians to build entirely new tools.
Okay, so after Kummer, did the problem just go quiet for a while? Yeah. Felt too hard?
It did seem to lie dormant for quite some time, yeah. It became seen as this sort of quirky, isolated puzzle, not really connected to the mainstream of math, a bit of a backwater.
But then things changed.
Dramatically. The story takes this unexpected turn after World War II over in Japan. Two young mathematicians, Yutaka Taniyama and Goro Shimura.
What did they do?
They proposed something really radical, very speculative at the time. It's now called the Taniyama-Shimura conjecture.
Okay.
It suggested a deep, hidden connection between two fields of math that seemed completely unrelated, elliptic curves.
Which are?
Think of them as equations that define specific kinds of complex, twisty shapes, like the surface of a donut, but defined by algebra. Very geometric.
Okay, geometry.
Yeah.
And the other field.
Modular forms. These are, well, they're incredibly complicated mathematical objects, highly symmetric, repeating patterns that live in a sort of abstract, higher dimensional space, very much in the realm of analysis and number theory.
So donuts and complex wallpaper patterns. They said these were linked.
That's a decent analogy, yeah. It sounded completely wild at the time, like discovering that, I don't know, the laws of gravity were secretly related to the rules of chess. Two different mathematical worlds.
But somehow this connects back to Fermat. How?
Ah, well, that connection wasn't made immediately by Taniyama and Shimura. It came a bit later, through the work of Gerhard Frey, Jean-Pierre Serre, and Ken Rebet.
What did they figure out?
Frey had the initial insight. He showed that if, and this is a big hypothetical if, you actually could find a solution to Fermat's equation for sum greater than 2.
If Fermat was wrong.
Yes. Then that hypothetical solution, those XYZ numbers, could be used to construct a really, really weird elliptic curve. An elliptic curve so strange it seemed like it probably shouldn't exist.
Okay, a bizarre curve linked to a Fermat solution.
Then Serre refined this idea, and crucially, Rebet proved it. He proved that this bizarre elliptic curve Frey described could not be modular. It couldn't possibly have a corresponding modular form partner, according to the rules known then.
Wait, so if a Fermat solution exists, it creates this weird curve.
Yep.
And this weird curve cannot be modular.
Correct.
But the Taniyama-Shimura conjecture says every elliptic curve is modular.
Exactly. You see the implication. If the Taniyama-Shimura conjecture is true, that every elliptic curve has a modular form buddy, then Frey's weird curve can't exist.
And if the weird curve can't exist,
then the hypothetical Fermat solution that created it can't exist either.
Wow. So proving Taniyama-Shimura automatically proves Fermat's last theorem.
Bingo. Suddenly, this 350-year-old dusty problem wasn't a backwater anymore. It was directly linked to one of the deepest, most central, most important conjectures in modern mathematics. The entire game changed overnight.
And that sets the stage for Andrew Wiles.
Andrew Wiles, a professor at Princeton. He'd actually been obsessed with Fermat's last theorem since he was a kid, maybe 10 years old.
Seriously. Since he was 10.
Found it in a library book and was just captivated by it. When this connection via Taniyama-Shimura became clear in the mid-80s, he basically decided, this is it. This is my chance.
What did he do?
He dropped everything else, all his other research projects, and for the next 7 years, he worked in almost complete secrecy in his attic office, trying to prove the Taniyama-Shimura conjecture.
7 years. In secret. Why the secrecy?
Math can be competitive, but also he felt the problem was so famous, the pressure would be unbearable if people knew he was working on it. He needed intense focus.
Singh's book must cover this period really well.
Oh, it's gripping. He describes the long years of solitary work, the breakthroughs, the dead ends, culminating in June 1993 at a conference in Cambridge, England.
The big reveal.
Wiles gives a series of lectures, and in the final lecture, he writes the conclusion on the blackboard, proving Taniyama-Shimura for the crucial set of curves, and then he just calmly says, I think I'll stop here. The room apparently erupted. It was huge news.
So solved. End of story.
Not quite. Here comes the drama. The proof was incredibly complex. Hundreds of pages. It went out to peer review to be checked by other experts.
Yeah.
And they found a gap. A subtle but deep flaw in one crucial part of the argument. It didn't invalidate everything, but it was serious. The proof was incomplete.
Oh, no. After 7 years of secret work and the public announcement, devastating.
Utterly devastating for Wiles. Singh really conveys the despair he felt. He'd thought he'd reached the summit, only to find a chasm still to cross.
What did he do?
He went back. Back into isolation, this time collaborating with a former student, Richard Taylor. They spent another intense year, almost a year of desperate struggle, trying to bridge that gap.
And they did it.
Yes. In September 1994, Wiles had this sudden, brilliant flash of insight. He realized that the technique that had failed could be combined with another method he'd tried years earlier but abandoned. Together, they worked. The gap was closed.
The final piece of the puzzle.
The final piece. This time, the proof held up. Fermat's last theorem, after 358 years, was finally, definitively proven.
What an incredible story of persistence. Just, wow. Okay, let's pull back a bit. What are the main themes or messages Singh wants us to take away from this whole saga?
I think there are three big ones. The first is something we touched on, the power of pursuing useless knowledge.
Meaning knowledge just for its own sake, not for any practical application.
Exactly. Fermat's problem had no obvious practical use for centuries. People worked on it purely out of curiosity for the beauty of the challenge, yet the tools they invented along the way.
Like Coomer's ideal numbers.
Precisely. That led to algebraic number theory, which, completely unexpectedly, turned out to be absolutely fundamental for modern cryptography.
Cryptography, like secure online stuff?
Yep. The math securing your online bank account, your secure communications. A lot of it rests on the foundations built by mathematicians chasing the supposedly useless puzzle. It's a huge argument for basic research.
That's a powerful point. What's the second theme?
Productive failure. We saw it again and again. Euler's struggle, Coomer's flawed proof, even Wiles' initial failed proof.
But they weren't just dead ends.
Not at all. Each failure taught the mathematical community something crucial. It revealed hidden complexities, forced the invention of new concepts. It's like failure isn't the opposite of success here. It's an essential part of the process. It refines the tools, sharpens the questions.
That's a good lesson for, well, pretty much anything difficult in life, isn't it?
Absolutely. Resilience, learning from mistakes, not giving up.
And the third theme.
The hidden unity of mathematics. The final proof didn't come from just refining old methods used on Fermat itself. It came from building this completely unexpected bridge between elliptic curves and modular forms.
Those two separate mathematical continents.
Exactly. It suggests there's this deep underlying structure, this surprising harmony connecting different parts of the mathematical universe that we don't always see.
And the lesson there for us might be, look for solutions in unexpected places.
Yeah, definitely. When you're stuck, maybe the answer lies in connecting ideas from a totally different field or perspective. Don't stay siloed.
The book must be full of memorable lines or ideas that really capture this spirit.
Oh, absolutely. Singh weaves them in beautifully.
What stands out, obviously, Fermat's marginal note itself.
That's the ultimate one, isn't it? I have discovered a truly marvelous proof, which this margin is too narrow to contain. Just the audacity. It echoes down the centuries.
And it keeps that question alive. Did he really have it?
It fuels the mystery. Then there's Andrew Wiles' own description of doing mathematical research. It's a fantastic metaphor.
What does he say?
He compared it to exploring a dark mansion. You enter the first room, and it's dark. Completely dark. You stumble around, bumping into the furniture.
Okay, I can picture that.
Gradually, you learn where each piece of furniture is. And finally, after 6 months or so, you find the light switch, you turn it on, and suddenly it's all illuminated. Ugh. You see exactly where you were. Then, he says, you move into the next dark room.
That perfectly captures the long periods of confusion and struggle before the breakthrough. The eureka moment isn't the start. It's the reward for groping in the dark.
Exactly. It emphasizes the endurance required. And maybe one more key idea. The nature of mathematical proof itself.
What about it?
Singh stresses that a mathematical proof is absolute. It's not like a scientific theory that might be refined or overturned later. A proof is a chain of logical deductions that, if correct, is true forever. Eternal certainty.
And that's the allure, why people dedicate their lives to it.
It's a huge part of it. The quest for that kind of absolute, unchanging truth in a complex world.
Okay, let's bring this down to earth a bit. Yeah. What are some real-life applications or takeaways for, you know, the rest of us?
Well, building on Wiles' story, there's a powerful lesson about deep work.
His 7 years in the attic.
Yeah. In our world, which is so full of distractions, notifications, constant connection, his story is this stark reminder that achieving something truly difficult and original often requires sustained, focused, uninterrupted concentration.
Turning off the noise.
For potentially long periods. It's a skill that's maybe becoming rarer, but Wiles shows how incredibly powerful it can be. Deep work gets deep results.
That's very relevant today. What else?
Resilience and humility, especially from Wiles fixing that flaw in his proof.
Right, having to admit it wasn't quite right after the big announcement.
Imagine that feeling. Well, but true resilience wasn't just about pushing through difficulty. It was having the humility to accept criticism, to re-examine his own work rigorously, and to persevere, even when the goal seemed agonizingly close but still out of reach.
That final year must have been incredibly tough. Maybe tougher than the first seven.
Arguably, yes. It takes real courage to face failure at that stage and go back into the trenches.
For me, reading about this, what really stood out was how innovation happened when old knowledge met completely new methods. Fermat stated the problem, but the solution needed Taniyama Shimura, this modern, unexpected connection.
That's a great point. It wasn't just about being smarter. It was about connecting different domains of thought.
Okay, final thoughts. What's the one thing that really sticks with you from Fermat's enigma? What surprised you most?
For me, I think it was the sheer drama of that final stretch. The Wiles proof, the flaw, the fix. We think of math as cold and abstract, but Singh makes it feel like a high-stakes thriller. The human element was just incredibly powerful.
Yeah, I agree. It reads like a novel in places. My final takeaway is maybe just the sheer beauty of the pursuit itself. That for 358 years, people dedicated so much intellectual energy to this, driven mostly by pure curiosity.
That's the lasting insight, isn't it? The book really makes you feel that the quest for knowledge, even seemingly abstract knowledge, is one of humanity's grandest adventures. And maybe the journey, all that struggle and invention over the centuries, was ultimately more valuable than just finding the answer. It proves that equations can be characters in deeply moving human stories.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.